Welcome to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. I'm Gordon Fellis. Today, our program takes us to Portland and the Muskie School of Public Policy at USM for a talk on healthcare here in Maine. A panel of speakers will discuss what federal healthcare reform will mean for Mainers. The speakers include Dr. Eric Steele, interim CEO of Blue Hill Memorial Hospital, Elizabeth Mitchell, CEO of Maine Health Management Coalition, and Trish Riley from the Maine Governor's Office of Health Policy and Finance. Thanks to generous member support, you can find this program and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs online at mpbn.net. Just look under the On Demand tab for Audio On Demand, another service made possible by member support. Moderating the discussion is Dr. Andrew Coburn, Professor and Chair of Health Policy and Management at the Muskie School.
Welcome from the University of Southern Maine and the Muskie School to the forum, Policy Soundings today. We like to encourage with the Chamber community discussions of critical policy questions. I can't think of a more critical problem that the state faces, the nation faces, than the problem of healthcare costs that we're going to be talking about today. In our unique public-private healthcare system that we have, there is a need to understand the different perspectives that really, the different systems that really constitute our healthcare system. And so we've put together a panel this morning of folks from different parts of the healthcare system who can speak to us about this question of healthcare reform and whether or not it will enable us as a state to address this critical problem of healthcare costs. Today we'll first hear from Eric Steele. Dr. Eric Steele is the interim CEO of Blue Hill Memorial Hospital. He'll be followed by Elizabeth Mitchell, who is the CEO of the Healthcare Management Coalition, and Trish Riley, who is the director of the Governor's Office of Health Policy and Finance. Following their presentations, we will have a question and answer period, and you have on your tables before you pencils and index cards. Please, as you listen to Eric, Dr. Steele, and Elizabeth Mitchell and others, please make sure to note all of your questions so that we can pick those up, and I will sort through those, and we'll try to get to as many of those as we can in the question and answer period. With that, let's get started. It's my pleasure, first of all, to introduce Dr. Eric Steele, who wears many hats in this healthcare system, as you will learn. Dr. Steele is the interim CEO, as I said, of Blue Hill Memorial Hospital, which is one of seven hospitals in the Eastern Maine healthcare system. Eastern Maine Health System is a 33-company health system in rural Maine. He is also the chief medical officer of Eastern Maine Health System, a role he has served in since 2005. His principal project in his chief medical officer role has been the system's signature Zero Defects Project, a patient safety initiative which is set as a system-wide goal, the elimination of preventable errors by 2012. Dr. Steele has served as keynote speaker for many of us at local and national forums on issues ranging from patient empowerment to controlling healthcare costs to performance improvement in the healthcare system. He attended Bowdoin College. He's a Maine native. I don't know if you're a Maine native, but you attended Bowdoin College.
Married a Maine native.
There you go. That doesn't make you a Maine native. I can attest to that. I married a Maine native. In Brunswick, receiving a BA in history and government, he then attended New England College of Osteopathic Medicine in Biddeford and is board certified in family medicine and the American Board of Family Physicians. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Steele.
It's a real pleasure to be here this morning, and what I'm going to give you is a perspective that's primarily based on one of my hats, which is as a primary care physician on the whole issue of controlling costs. And I thought what I would try to do is give you a little bit of insight into what my life is like wearing that hat. And to give you a sense of, as I confront the whole issue of healthcare costs and trying to control those costs, what I struggle with as I try to do that. I am a believer in the health reform legislation for two reasons. One, I think it ultimately will lead us pretty close to universal insurance. Second, I think it includes a number of things that will ultimately start deflecting the cost of care curve downward. But that said, I think all of you from Portland know what it's like, the big tankers coming up the channel, and that legislation is like one of those tugboats hitting the bow. We're just gonna start changing the direction slowly. And we shouldn't have this tremendous idea that it's magically going to make us all happy. If it doesn't piss you off, then you're not thinking about it. But we also should understand that its goal is to change the trajectory of our healthcare system over the next 10 years. That's kind of how I see this. So I want to take you inside my practice, and while that's the main hat I'm going to be wearing, I wear a lot of hats. I work in rural emergency departments. I'm the interim CEO of a small critical access hospital on the coast of Maine. I'm an employer, an executive of an employer that employs over 8,000 people and insures over 10,000. And last year, our health care costs for those employees were $47 million. And at the current rate of increase of our health care costs, they will be over $150 million in 10 years. So I am one of you in this issue. I'm a columnist. I write on health care for the Bangor Daily News. And I'm also the father and father-in-law of two physicians. My daughter will start her residency in emergency medicine in Stanford in about 2 weeks, and my son-in-law will start his residency in anesthesia there in about 2.5 weeks. And I'm a patient, too, as we all are. So all of those perspectives. So the hat of a typical family doc, that doc has about 2,500 to 3,000 active patients, makes about $170,000 a year, does patient care about 4.5 days a week, but a day is often about 10 hours plus, sees about 4 patients an hour, 25 plus to maybe 30 patients in a day, and all of them virtually now are paid on a productivity basis. The more patients you see, the higher complexity of the patients you see, the more money you make. So at best, you got about 12 minutes per office visit per patient. So if you don't remember anything else today, remember that number. Because whatever you want primary care providers to do, to control healthcare costs, to improve population health, to get diabetics their care, et cetera, they're trying to do it on 12 minutes per patient for each of those visits. Whatever you want them to do, it's got to fit into that number. So a little bit of a taste of my life now as a primary care doc. I want to show you a few phone calls, and then I'm going to give you a case to think about. And you can all be the doc of the moment, and we'll work on that case. So what I'm showing you is some typical phone calls to me in my office on my electronic medical record. And the first of these patients is a patient who's had a cancerous tumor on his kidney now for a year, but he doesn't know if his insurance is going to pay for it to be removed, and he has a house. And he's afraid that if he has his surgery and he ends up with a big fat bill that his insurance doesn't cover, they're going to take his house to help pay for his uncovered bill. So I've been trying to talk him for a year into having this cancer removed. And so he's called me back to talk about it, and he wants to talk about it some more. The next patient here wants me to write a note saying that she should be off of work. Her husband is divorcing her, suing her. She's got some bad pain. He wants her income. She wants a note saying she should be out of work because of the problems I'm treating her for. The next patient here is one who's in Las Vegas and ran out of her methadone and is hoping I can somehow get a methadone prescription called into a pharmacy in Las Vegas. And the next one here Who the heck knows? The next one is having a fight with their insurance company over a medication choice. The insurance company doesn't like my choice. She likes my choice, wants me to call and fight with the insurance company. This is a patient who wants the follow-up on a test. This is a patient, a woman calling about her son who's just told her that he's having some suicidal thoughts. And so I need to talk to him and find out, is he just kind of thinking about this or has he got a plan? And if he's got a plan, he needs emergent help. And I got to try to make that assessment over the phone and figure out what am I going to do. And then this one, this patient wants a referral to a chiropractor and wants me to pay for that. Wants me to approve that so it will be paid for. And what do I get paid for that hour's worth of work? It's basically nothing. And so all of this stuff that I do by phone, I don't get paid for. It adds substantially to my day. These days now, I'm getting emails too. Also, most of that not compensated for. But I don't have enough time in my office schedule to bring all of these patients in where I actually might get paid to deal with all this. So now I want to take you to a case for you to think about. And remember, we're trying to control costs as you think about this case. So I got a patient. He comes in. He's got blood in his urine. And he's about 47. And he's otherwise a pretty healthy guy. And so I do a CAT scan of his abdomen and pelvis. And it turns out he's got a kidney stone. But the CAT scan gets the lower part of his lungs just because the lungs go down behind the abdomen. And he's got, turns out, he's got this solitary pulmonary nodule. He's got a spot in his lung. Just happened to find it. So the radiologist says, well, the guidelines would say get another CAT scan of the chest in 12 months to assure stability of this nodule and make sure it's not cancer. But if he's at high risk for cancer, maybe you should do a CAT scan of his lungs now, because if there are more nodules, then maybe it is cancer. So is it just an innocent nodule that we found when looking for something else? Or is it something like this, which is a lung cancer? So that's the dilemma now that I face, having just, all I wanted was a damn CAT scan to find out if he had a kidney stone. And now I got this mess to deal with, which, by the way, is also by the phone. So here's the question right off the bat for me. Is this a cancer? If it's low risk, as the radiologist says, how low risk is acceptable low risk for me and for him? So should I order a full CAT scan now to make sure there are no other nodules? If there are no other nodules, probably not a cancer. But if there are other nodules, maybe indeed it is a cancer. So we're going to talk about this for a minute here. And so here are the rules. Don't screw this up. Don't kill this patient. Make zero errors in his care. And don't piss the patient off. He's actually a good patient. He has good insurance. I actually like him, and I've been taking care of him and his family for about 15 years. But don't waste any money, and the other patients are waiting for you to see them, doc, while you're making this decision. So what would you do? Who would do what? Who would order the CAT scan, which, by the way, will cost about $1,000, and who would say, no, we're just going to order one in a year and make sure. Does anyone want to take a pass at that? This is really discouraging. So in an ideal world, I would have the latest evidence at my fingertips about what to do with this. I wouldn't just have the radiologist's opinion about this. I'd have the latest evidence about how much an additional CAT scan increases a patient's lifetime risk of cancer just from the radiation exposure, because actually it does. And I would be able to compare that risk with this risk, and I would have this discussion with the patient, and I'd have a nice brochure explaining all this to the patient so that I didn't have to take 30 minutes in the office while all the other patients are waiting to explain this to him. In an ideal world, he's engaged. He wants to have this discussion, and he wants to have a thoughtful discussion, a good discussion about risk and benefit, and we would make a good decision, which I think in this case would be, we don't get a CAT scan to see if there are other nodules now. We just do what the radiologist recommended, which is get another CAT scan in a year to make sure it's just one nodule and it stays that way. and it wasn't of any significance. So in the real world, I got basically no time to make this decision, or very little. I have little evidence at my fingertips beyond the radiologist's opinion based on who the heck knows. I have a patient mostly engaged in his fear of cancer, not in saving money, and not in a discussion about the evidence, and he wants a CAT scan, and he wants it now. He has insurance which will pay most of it, about $1,000, so he has little or no money in this discussion, no skin in this game, other than, could this be a cancer in my lung, which is substantial skin. So if we wait a year and turns out it's been a cancer, he's probably dead, and I'm going to get sued, in all probability. His wife is a healthcare provider, by the way, who's telling him, get the damn CAT scan. So all of this, I get paid basically nothing for this complex, risky decision-making. If you get any of this wrong, the consequences potentially for you and for the patient in particular can be catastrophic. And I, as the physician, have virtually no incentive to save money by not getting this CAT scan. So I told all of you that to tell all of you this, that as a family doc in the current system, I have almost no incentive to save money in the system. I have almost no support to save money in the system. Most patients still have relatively little incentive to save money in the system, although that's rapidly changing for many patients. And the health system that employs me has no incentive to save money except its own and for its own employees, except for me and them having at least some sense of social responsibility to be responsible with your money. So most of the time, this is what this feels like. You feel like you're on your own, on a tightrope, and if you get pushed one way or another and get it wrong, it's a free fall to a disaster for you, for the patient, etc. So that means if you want me to save money as a family physician in this system, I need support. I need an engaged patient who's got some financial skin in the game. Not so much that they make dumb decisions, and it has to be different for different patients. A working mom making $28,000 a year can't have a $1,000 copay between her and basic care. A guy like me making $250,000 a year can afford $1,000 between him and making this decision. So it's got to be adjusted for the ability to pay, or you will get smart people to do very dumb things in order to save their share of healthcare dollars with skin in the game. I got to have malpractice reform at least protect me when I do the right thing and I follow the evidence, at least give me some protection for that. So if it all goes wrong, I'm still not getting sued for doing the right thing. I need employer support through insurance benefit design that gives patients skin in the game. I need employers to get engaged in the whole issue of employee health promotion. I need employers to work to get their employees into this game. I need patient decision-making aids, things that can help them think through this decision so that the whole thing doesn't depend on my going through every single bit of it, and that they can then make some of these decisions or pieces of them themselves or think about it with family and then come to me for the part of the decision that they need my help making, that last piece of it perhaps. I need insurance company support, less red tape, more money for decision-making, counseling, et cetera. You want me to talk to this patient about not having a CAT scan, why I think that's a waste of money, et cetera, a difficult 30-minute conversation perhaps about risk and benefit that maybe kind of plays out over 2 weeks as he thinks about it, says, yeah, I'm not going to do it. He goes home. His wife says he's an idiot. He calls me back up, says he's yes, he wants the CAT scan. I talk to him again, say, think about it. Maybe come in with your wife. They come in. They say it's okay. Okay, they go home. Her mother says they're an idiot. They come back, et cetera. So you want support. You got to pay me, help pay for the decision-making. Legislative support. Bottom line is this issue. Reducing cost is a team support. If you want me to do it in isolation, in my office, standing on the tightrope, with this patient in front of me, wanting a CAT scan to make sure he doesn't have a cancer in his chest, I cannot do that alone. So there are no easy answers in my office. There are no easy answers in all of this. And if the answers on a macro scale sound easy, you're not thinking them through. I think that's true of issues such as individual responsibility. I believe in it. If we think this is going to solve healthcare costs, we're crazy. If it were 60% of the people coming into my office would not be overweight, we would not have an epidemic of childhood obesity in this country, et cetera. Individual responsibility is a great thing. It's profoundly important, but it doesn't happen alone. It takes a village to raise a responsible person around their healthcare. If we think the free market is just going to fix all this, the free market is part of what's gotten us here. It's not the only solution either. Universal insurance in and of itself isn't going to fix this thing. There are no simple answers in my office or in healthcare cost control. But I don't think, despite everything I've said, that it's hopeless. There is a tremendously growing energy around controlling costs that I think is really kind of reaching a fever pitch, driven in part by the sheer desperation of people such as you trying to control your business costs and get your employees' insurance. And that desperation is driving us further and further and faster and faster. The groups like Elizabeth's, the Maine Health Management Coalition, these multi-stakeholder groups are coming together in partnership, business, insurance, providers, government, et cetera. I think they are a potential solution for us, especially in a state like Maine. Patient engagement is increasing rapidly, in part because they have more of their own dollars at risk. Our company this year, 8,500 employees, put a donut hole in people's insurance where between about $2,000 and $3,500, you're paying all that out of your pocket except for preventive costs. I suddenly have more people talking to me about, do I really need that test, than I have ever had in the past. I just hope I don't get it wrong. Simply getting patients and providers to discuss, what could I do to avoid having this test, this procedure, taking this medication, et cetera, this kind of engagement, a patient actually wanting to have this kind of conversation with me so that I don't feel like I'm trying to push this concept, this stone uphill against the tide of the patient's energy around just having the test, having the procedure, finding the answer, et cetera. If I could have this kind of engagement, I think I could make a big dent in cost and care that's really of marginal value, which I think there's tremendous opportunity to save dollars in. There's growing organizational support for providers like me doing this kind of thing. Most primary care providers now work for larger organizations. Those organizations have growing sophistication in decision support for cost-effective, high-quality care. Locally, Martin's Point, I think, is an example of this kind of cutting-edge organization getting ready to take on risk for costs. That will absolutely change the game. When my employer is going to be incentivized to actually reduce these costs, it is going to change the dynamic behind me and my patient care in the office to one in which either they don't care whether I spend money or they're happy that I'm spending money because we make money on CAT scans and surgeries and so forth. If those organizations that employ physicians are now into the game of trying to control cost, that will be a game changer, I believe. Electronic medical records are changing this as well. In our healthcare system, by the end of November of this year, we will have the primary care medical records of 100,000 Mainers on one data system. We will be able to tell you about their care, about what diabetics have in head, what care they're supposed to, et cetera. Those systems can bring me online references at a few keystrokes about what should I do in certain situations. When you can make that kind of decision support instantly available, you can make decision support available in the 12-minute context. That's potentially a game changer. So this is not a hopeless thing. And finally, I think those of you who are old enough will recognize the photo up here of the gun to the head of the dog as coming from the cover of, I think it was Vanity Fair about 20 years ago. But the gun really is to our heads. The fact that we're all feeling it now will change how we think and what we're willing to do in order to control cost. And really the only question is whether we will take it out of the healthcare system, take these many dollars that we need to ratchet these costs down in a way that will injure the system and cause substantial harm, or can we do it in a way that over several years, 10 years, will reduce the cost curve, but do it in a way that minimizes the potential harmful impact, taking it primarily out of waste, getting to better care models, getting people healthy up front so they're not so expensive to care for, et cetera. So I, believe it or not, am a restless optimist to all of this. I want to take the last few minutes that I have and just give you, take you back to the case. So what did I do? Well, guess what? Here's a big surprise. I ordered the CAT scan of the chest. So it was normal, as I thought it would be, and we wasted the money. But, so he sleeps because he knows he doesn't have cancer. I sleep, although I'm a little bit guilty about having wasted the money. My malpractice attorney, he sleeps as well. The hospital gets paid for the CT scan. You all paid for that CT scan. Thank you very much. And we wasted money in the larger sense. On the other hand, we increased his cancer risk down the line, but those are other problems for someone else another day and down the road, and he'll have a repeat CAT scan in 1 year. Welcome to my world. So if we don't save money through waste reduction, I want to give you just very briefly in the few minutes I have left a sort of bigger provider perspective. This is Blue Hill Memorial Hospital that I run, started in 1922, 25-bed critical access hospital, biggest employer in the Blue Hill area, 35 active medical staff members. And I want to get to this. About $44 million in revenue, about of some of that. The biggest thing we do is provide primary care office visits, which is the most cost-effective care that there is. It's the one care shown to reduce unnecessary deaths, reduce morbidity, save money in healthcare, et cetera. And of all the things we do, it's the least cost effective. So I'll skip through all this. But in rural Maine now, the model has become that virtually every primary care physician is employed by a hospital. So now when you're talking about hospitals in rural Maine, you're now talking about these little healthcare systems, which are, in Blue Hill's case, we are all of the primary care for 20,000 people. All of the preventive care, almost all of the mental health care, all of the prenatal care, all of the pediatric care, all of the geriatric care, most of the public health, most of the family planning, most of the chronic disease management, et cetera, and all the physicians for local schools, the support for cancer groups, troubled teen groups, medical directors for the local nursing home. We have the home health care company. We're the largest employer. We provide health insurance, on and on and on. And we're this little health system. So from our humble origin of 5 beds and 1 physician, we have basically become the almost sole provider of care for 20,000 people. So 78% of primary care providers in Maine are now employed by hospitals. In rural Maine, it's virtually 100%. It's most of the general surgeons. It's many of the orthopedists. Again and again and again around Maine, 23 of Maine's nursing homes are owned by hospitals, 16 of the home health agencies, at least 9 of the local ambulance companies, et cetera. So if you take all that, what we got to make it do locally is add up. So primary care loses money, ED loses money, social work loses money, skilled rehab probably loses money, nursing home, borderline home health agencies, borderline or lose money, inpatient beds, maybe break even, OB loses money, medical admissions, many of them lose money, lab and imaging make money, surgery make money, joint replacements make a lot of money. So 44,000 visits, remember, in primary care, only about 14% of our revenue, and it's on a per-visit basis the thing we make the least money on. In fact, we lose money on it. So the greatest money is made in joints, and if you put it another way, this is an inverted pyramid in which the primary care and population health management for 20,000 people and the primary care and the psychiatric care and the home health care and the nursing home, et cetera, the inpatient beds, et cetera, all rests on the head of a pin. Surgical and other procedures, especially total joints, which is why when you talk about the idea of taking total joints and moving them to places like EMMC, which is in our system, et cetera, it sends me screaming into the night. Because if you do that, I will not have the head of the pin, and I will lose the ability in the current model to support the population health for all of the people of the Blue Hill Peninsula. So I'll finish there, and thank you very much for your attention.
So let me now introduce Elizabeth Mitchell. Elizabeth is a former state legislator, of course, from Portland. She is currently serving as the CEO of Maine Health Management Coalition, an employer-led multi-stakeholder coalition whose mission is to improve the value of health services. The coalition is actively engaged, as you'll hear, in performance measurement, public reporting, and payment reform and health system redesign with many of the stakeholders that are central to the system involved as partners. Elizabeth also serves as chair of Maine's Chartered Value Exchange, co-director of Maine's Aligning Forces for Quality project, a major national project that is getting quite a bit of visibility, and on the advisory committee of the Maine Quality Forum, which is a governmental entity as part of the DIRGO agency. She's also on the board of Quality Counts and the Network for Regional Health Improvement and several other related organizations. So please welcome Elizabeth Mitchell.
My colleagues are laughing at me because they know that all means I just go to a lot of meetings. But I do want to make one disclaimer. I am not running for any office. I am a recovered politician. Thank you. But I would say that running a multi-stakeholder collaborative of employers, providers, and health plans trying to fix the healthcare system is a lot taller order than running for governor. So don't tell anyone I said that. But the question will... the healthcare reform help solve Maine's cost crisis? I think there's a simple answer. It depends. It depends entirely on what we do, what everybody in this room does, what everybody in Maine decides to do together. Everyone is going to be challenged to change current behavior, current payment, current patterns of accessing care. It is a tall order, and our only hope is to do this together. So, we heard Eric speak very eloquently about the real-life, day-to-day challenges of making hard decisions to take responsibility not only for the patients, who have got to be everybody's priority, but also for the resources that every provider is entrusted with to make good decisions about. So what are we doing right now at the big picture? We are paying, we, and I mean all of us, through our benefit design, through every time we pay for an employee's care, this is what we're paying for. We're paying, unfortunately, for preventable conditions, for acute care episodes, and high-cost outcomes, and sometimes we're paying for complications, infections, and readmissions. Now, what we want to be paying for is everything that we're that is not incented in the current system, continued health, no hospitalization, efficient, successful outcomes. Now, I'm not suggesting we don't get those a lot of the time, but the current incentives are paying for the wrong things. And I would let you know that there's an estimate that every hospital-acquired infection adds about $30,000 to a bill. Now, I don't think anyone would suggest that not paying for that infection is rationing. Nobody wants an unhealthy, unsuccessful outcome of care. So there are ways to improve what we're doing now without limiting access to anything that we want or need. Well, maybe not want, but need. So we get what we pay for. This is exactly what Eric was talking about. We as employers have designed these incentives, those who are purchasing care. We want informed employees. We want improved outcomes. We want care coordination of prevention, functional status, and return to work. But we are paying for tests, visits, procedures, everything that Eric has to do to subsidize the right care at the right time. We are hamstringing primary care, even though they have the biggest potential to make sure that our employee population stays healthy. We are not giving them the time, the resources, and the equipment they need to be able to do their jobs effectively. So I would say that it is incumbent upon all of us to look at how we are working together to improve the system. We're also creating benefit designs with entirely the wrong incentives. If there are This is not always the case. We're seeing some really progressive purchasing in Maine. But if you have a $30 to $40 copay for an asthma inhaler and one of your employees can't afford that, think about what you're going to pay for the hospitalization when they don't get the care they need at the right time. So the good news is we have actually quantified savings opportunities in Maine. The Maine Quality Forum did this research a couple of years ago, or a year ago, and they have identified savings of a lot in just one of these areas. If we reduced by 25%, there's $14.2 million a year there just in the cardiac circulatory. We know this can be done. This is a lot of money on the table that we could actually take out of the system without harming anyone, without actually limiting access to appropriate and needed care. So we've quantified these opportunities, and we really need to be paying attention to how we get there. All right, and we're going to keep going. So what do we do about it? Well, I would say everybody in this room has a role. As employers, we need to have the patient incentives to the right benefit design, and we need to use our leverage to identify and reward those high-value providers. The providers like Eric who are trying to do the right thing, we want to make sure we pay them effectively so that they can do the right thing. We also need our providers, and Eric has mentioned also, they're recognizing their role in this. They're stepping up to the challenge of improving the system. We need high-value, coordinated, and patient-centered care. Most of the time we get that in Maine. Maine has some of the highest quality health care in the country, and we need to be really proud of that. We also need to sustain it. We need to increase primary care and disease management. We need transparent cost and quality information. There are differences in how care is delivered in Maine. We don't have the information to know what those differences are. If you are going to choose between a hospital or a primary care provider, wouldn't you want to know if they have higher quality scores or if they are more cost-effective and cost-efficient? We don't have the information we need to make those informed choices right now in Maine. One of the things the coalition does is try to publish that information in a way that's user-friendly. That is an extremely tall order. It is a very difficult thing to do. But it is extremely important, and we hear from consumers, we hear from the patients, they want that information. They want to be informed and make good healthcare decisions. They need that information. Health plans, we're going to need them to think differently about what their roles are. We need to look at new payment models, not just the fee-for-service that has gotten us into this mess. And then patients, we want them to be responsible for their own personal health, and we want informed choice and engagement to seek the right care at the right time in the most appropriate setting. So what is this bill going to do for us, potentially? Well, the focus of the bill and what everyone heard about in the media was about access. It was about expanding insurance. And that's great. We fully support that. But what we didn't hear enough about was cost containment opportunities. So buried in there, though, I think are some really exciting things, that, or at least they're exciting to policy wonks. But creating a center for Medicare and Medicaid innovation that will authorize CMS to consider and approve payment reforms without explicit congressional approval. We may have the opportunity to work with CMS to do things radically differently. We may have some relief from some of the regulatory framework that keeps us from making the changes we want to make. Maine is extremely well positioned to take on some of these innovative projects. It creates new waiver authority to explicitly authorize ACO demonstrations. What is an ACO? I would say almost nobody really knows. It is an accountable care organization. It is what everybody, the organizing principle that is really getting traction in the whole healthcare reform discussion. It is when a healthcare provider system takes accountability for the cost and quality of their population of patients. Now, that sounds obvious. Unfortunately, it has not been the case in many situations. So if we can create and support these new accountable care organizations, I think there's huge potential there to control costs and improve quality. It establishes penalties for readmission, so those incentives that we're talking about, if you're not paid for, maybe we're not saying that incentives drive physician behavior. We know better. We know they're doing the right things for the right reasons. But let's have the financial incentives support those decisions. And then it also requires the development of new outcome measures, so you may be able to see the performance differences between different provider groups. You might have that information to make informed decisions. So there, we'll end with that. I do want to say the goal here is not limiting access to care that anybody needs. It is to get the right care at the right time in the most appropriate setting. That is not rationing. That is not limiting access to needed services. This is about making sure people have access to the right services at a cost that is affordable. We were down in Washington last week with the nominated CMS administrator. He's not appointed yet. And he said he is going to be looking to regions, regions like Maine, where there is a history of collaboration to prove that healthcare can be fixed. And so there's a lot riding on us right now. They are looking to Maine. They think Maine has some of the biggest potential in the country to make this work because we do have the culture of collaboration. We have the collaborative infrastructure. They know that this is going to be about us working together to get this done. If we can do that, we prove that this can be done. And they are looking to us, and they will support us. We were promised that we would get the Medicare waivers we need. We will get the Medicare data we need. I think there is so much potential with this incoming administration to actually implement this bill effectively. But right now, if doctors do the right thing, they go out of business. That is not fair. It is not right. We know, for instance, that we've had patient-centered medical homes, which is actually the ideal primary care model. We know they go in certain regions. We've heard from their hospitals that within a year they're getting 20% reductions in volume in their emergency departments. That's not sustainable for them. So we're doing the right thing. We're paying for the right primary care in some regions, and it's putting hospitals in jeopardy. We can't do that. We need the hospitals. We need our whole system to stay in place and to be functional, but we need the right care at the right time in the most appropriate setting.
So we now turn to Trish Riley, and let me introduce her briefly. She is known to many of us in her long public service, most recently as the director of Governor Baldacci's Office of Health Policy and Finance, leading his effort to develop a comprehensive, coordinated health system in Maine and to assure affordable health insurance for all Maine citizens. She was the principal architect of DeRogo Health Reform and is responsible for its successful implementation. Trish has published and presented widely. She is known nationally for her work in state health reform. She also serves as a member of the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured. This is a very long-standing national body that has been in place probably for 15 or 20 years. And she was previously the CEO of the National Academy for State Health Policy, which is based here in Portland. So with that, welcome, please, Trish Riley.
Thank you. Good morning. What a group to follow. Elizabeth told us that we get what we pay for, but another adage that I think is important is that every system is designed precisely to get the results it gets. And when you think about the American health system that Eric so eloquently showed us visibly and recognized that we pay twice what every other developed nation pays, we don't get better health, we don't get better quality, and we don't take care of everybody, we don't cover everybody. That's a pretty damning set of facts. And we got here by acquiescence and action. This didn't happen by accident. So unbundling it and creating the payment reforms that are so essential that Elizabeth talked about is no easy task. Let's just reflect for a second. We have seen initiatives in this country and in this state that in fact contained costs. Many years ago, we had a rate-setting commission in Maine that, in fact, restrained the cost growth of hospitals. We had here in Maine a little bit, and in the country, managed care that restrained the growth of health care. Most recently, we've had the DeRogo Health Program that documented $180 million of savings in health care, and a recent report shows us that this had some impact on employer-based coverage. That we have in fact stopped. We were growing. Employer-based coverage, the coverage you all pay for, was growing double digits faster than national growth. Since our collective efforts began in 2003, we've tamed that growth more significantly than the nation. We've had some success. But all those cost containment activities, all of them, are extraordinarily controversial, as everybody here knows. Hospital rate reduction stopped when the hospitals pushed back and argued that it was too top-heavy. They couldn't be creative and facile. Managed care failed when consumers pushed back and said, wait a minute, there's an insurance company getting between me and my choice of physician, getting between me and the kind of care I need, even when that insurance company was working on the evidence that Eric talked about. When the insurance company was paying for what worked best, consumers rejected it. So we know that we have a history of action and acquiescence that's made it hard to contain costs, and it's going to make it very, very hard to do the work that Elizabeth and the coalition are so engaged in and that's so critically important. So we have employers, we have providers, we have plans at the table, critically important. Usually in those kinds of deliberations, as we're trying to move money in this system, in those kinds of deliberations, they usually work best when everybody has a win-win. Can we have a win-win and save money? Don't there have to be some losers, things we pay for that we no longer pay for, in order to invest in the kinds of primary care and activities that we need? How is this going to work? And at your peril, continue without consumers. We need consumers at the table. There's lots of good ideas about cost containment. Managed care, arguably, was a good idea about better managing care and constraining costs. But consumers told us otherwise. And that's an important voice to make sure we keep at this table. The bottom line for cost containment that we have to all remember is that one person's inefficiency is another person's salary. One person's waste is another person's profit. So as we think about how to make these very fundamental and difficult challenges, we have to really stay together and figure out how to achieve these kinds of ends. Now, in Maine, we're having a little bit of luck. As Elizabeth showed you, the documentation that we've produced that actually shows us that there are avoidable hospitalizations. People do not need to go to a costly hospital or a costly emergency department. They can be prevented. How? By better public health and prevention. If we don't get diabetes in the first place, we won't inappropriately use hospitals. And by better management of that care to make sure people don't get into the crisis situations that are preventable. What we've done in this year's State Health Plan, which is required by law each 2 years, is to create a report card for each of Maine's 8 public health districts that takes those preventable hospitalizations and shows how much money each district is wasting in preventable costs. Documents it, then documents the health status of that district, how much smoking, how much obesity, the kinds of things that drive public health. We will be able to look at that report card over time to measure our progress in getting the public health community more engaged in prevention, linking them with the clinical community of doctors and hospitals to make sure we manage care better. So we will be accountable, and we'll have a state health plan in place as a transitional document that really begins to link public health to cost containment. Secondly, Elizabeth mentioned the 26-state patient-centered medical home. This is very important, and we are really lucky in Maine that we have our major insurers and the Medicaid program working together to take 26 doctors' practices across the state and change how they do business so that we can, in fact, invest in primary care that works to keep us well and avoids the kinds of testing and duplication and the sorts of activities that we saw on Elizabeth's slide, so that we can really pay for prevention and better manage illness. But let's talk a bit about federal reform and what it does for employers and for cost containment. First and foremost, it continues the employer-based system. So it continues the system we know and love in this country. There are some immediate, though incremental, admittedly incremental steps that go into effect right now or soon. Most of the reform goes into effect in 2014. As I suspect you all know, small businesses are eligible for tax credits of up to 35% of the cost of health care for businesses with 25 or fewer full-time equivalent employees, so they can have more than 25 employees, with an average wage of $50,000. Those tax credits are available now, up to 35% of the cost of coverage if you as an employer are paying 50% of that cost, available now. There's a reinsurance plan. Those of you who have retiree health plans, as big businesses particularly, know that often Early retirees, those 55 but and over, but too young for Medicare, retire because they're sick and they have high health costs. Their high health costs drive premiums for your whole business. There's a reinsurance plan that goes into effect this summer that will pay for those high cost plans in big businesses, in businesses that offer these coverages, and in the public sector, that can reduce the costs of coverage for the rest of the workplace. And importantly, covering people brings down costs. It matters. When people have coverage and are not uninsured, their money pays for their care. Otherwise, we do. It's a hidden tax in uncompensated care that we all pay for. Right now, this summer, there'll be funds available. Maine's already applied to cover high-cost uninsured folks who have pre-existing conditions. Let me talk a little bit about Eric's points and try to go through some of the points he so eloquently made and what health reform will do about it. His first point was a critically important one about engaged consumers. First and foremost, in 2014, every individual must have health coverage. There is a mandate that says everybody has to have coverage. There is a mandate that protects that, and there's subsidies that help people provide it. Subsidies for people up to 400% of the poverty level. That's about $88,000 for a family of four, $43,000 for an individual, sliding scale based on income. And there's quote-unquote skin in the game. I hate that phrase, but you use it all the time. Consumers have to pay at least 2% of their income for care, for their coverage. They will pay no more than 9.5%, and they will get help with cost sharing as well, which is limited. There's more transparency. Prevention is covered 100%. No cost sharing for prevention to incentivize people to take good care of themselves. Eric talked to us about that patient and the need for him to spend time with his patients talking about options. In the health plan, we saw important new investments to pay for doctors to talk to patients about their choices. What happened? They were labeled death panels, and the debate was polarized. That's precisely what we can't allow to happen here and can't allow to happen in the implementation of this plan. We have to stay at the table and talk about these opportunities. Secondly, to Eric's point about malpractice, the federal reform, the Affordable Care Act, does provide for 5-year demonstrations to states in medical malpractice reform. Very important demonstrations, well-funded. And the results of those malpractice demonstrations will go right to Congress to make sure we get attention and get change. Eric talked a lot about the need for employer and insurance reforms. Get rid of the red tape, change the benefits, move to health promotion. And here I think potentially we have a home run in the federal reform. Again, to be developed, there's lots to be done before we know what it looks like completely. But in 2014, individuals and businesses as high as 100 employees will buy their health insurance through exchanges. And when we cover 100 employee businesses, that's 44,000 of Maine's 46,000 businesses. In 2017, companies over 100 are eligible for the exchange. So what's an exchange? It really does provide a new day. It creates new insurance regulations that require insurance companies to standardize their applications, to standardize their benefits, to simplify the information about those benefits. It pools individuals and small businesses together to buy health care together, to have that huge purchasing power together. It requires web-based information. You will be able to go in an exchange to a web and look at a chart. There'll be four plans, four benefit designs, gold, platinum, etc. The structure of those benefits will be laid out. Insurance companies can come and provide those four benefits. Any insurance company that wants to that's licensed in the state. The exchange, again, remember, provides the subsidies. Any coverage provided in the exchange is eligible for the subsidy dollars for people up to $88,000 for a family of four. You go to that exchange and you'll be able to say, here's what's offered. Apples to apples, simply understood. Here's what it costs. Here's what my deductible is. Here's what my deductible is for every member of the family. Here's how this program works, and here's what its quality is. For the first time, we'll have a regulated insurance industry. We'll have clear, understandable apples-to-apples comparative data. In addition to the four plan choices that have to be offered, every exchange across the country will have two plans that are multi-state plans. national plans offered across state lines, one of which must be offered by a nonprofit. It limits out-of-pocket costs, and it, again, very much invests in prevention and the kind of benefit design that Eric talked about. There is a business mandate. If we're going to keep an employer-based healthcare system, employers need to stay in the game. Again, the exchange is available for most employers in Maine. For those employers otherwise, large employers, there is a mandate that you either have to participate in this. If you have workers who are receiving these subsidies, you're going to have to pay something in exchange. Now, businesses of 50 and less are exempt from the mandate and from the penalties. That's many, many businesses in Maine. Businesses that are already providing coverage are virtually exempt. 98.5% of businesses over 50 in Maine, according to the Department of Labor, already provide coverage, and indeed provide almost 73% of the employee's share of that coverage. So there aren't too many people, too many businesses that will be subject to these mandates, but the mandates are there. There are wellness incentives included in the program that are important. 5-year grants to small businesses starting next year to develop wellness programs that make sense for little businesses. Requirements, again, that insurance must provide good preventive benefits with no cost sharing by consumers. Premium discounts are available up to 30% of the cost of the premium if your employees participate in wellness programs. And there are provisions in the law to protect those employees who are incapable of doing so. There'll be 10 state demonstrations for wellness initiatives in the individual market. There's more cost containment. In the Recovery Act, the foundation of health reform was laid by huge investments in health information exchange. And Maine is well ahead of the rest of the state through our health information network. This is a superhighway, so that if you are from Portland and get sick in Fort Kent, your information is immediately available to that doctor in Fort Kent. It means you get cared for sooner. It means there's less likelihood of medical errors, you getting a prescription to which you're allergic. It means there's less opportunity for redundant tests that are costly. We're well advanced in that. There's major commitments in the federal law to continue that. There's new insurance reforms in the plan, many of which Maine already has, but importantly, for the first time in large group businesses over 50, insurance companies will be required to spend 85 cents of every dollar on health care. They can spend 15 cents on taxes and profits and marketing, but 85 cents must be spent on health care. There's more transparency in information, such as Elizabeth suggested. There's an enormously restructured commitment at the federal level to going after fraud and abuse in health care. A big team of people looking at Medicare and Medicaid to make certain that that program is run as efficiently and effectively as possible, with SWAT teams available to go after abusers. And a new, important, sophisticated understanding that there are providers who year after year after year have done the right thing. They ought not to be penalized. So that's a really focused attention. There's new investments in primary care, increases in primary care in Medicaid and Medicare, subsidies, and finally, there's a new public health fund that's significant, with new investments in public health for the states, new investments in workforce. And finally, there is the ongoing commitment to cost containment, and that is a big part of this expanded access for people to cover all these new enrollees with all these subsidies. There's a huge investment of public dollars in subsidies. That investment will be indexed. The subsidies will keep track of and keep up with the growth in healthcare costs. So the Congress will be required each and every couple of years to decide, will we increase dollars for subsidies as healthcare costs grow, or will we insist that healthcare costs be constrained so that the subsidy expenditure of the federal government is also restrained? That, it seems to me, is an opportunity and a question. But I think, Eric, it's fair to say the federal reform has the promise of many answers to the issues that you raised so eloquently. Thank you.
So thanks to all of our speakers for wonderfully concise and insightful presentations. If you have cards, please pass them around. Nancy from the chamber and others will be going around and picking those up, and I'll be sorting through those, and we'll try to get to as many of them as we possibly can. I, as the prerogative of the moderator, will throw out a first question for all of our speakers while I go through the questions and pick out some of the highlighting questions. And the question that I want to ask is to get to what I see in some of the cards, the questions on these cards is, how long can we wait? You know, the premium increases that we all experience on a year-to-year basis are shocking. You know, if you're running a small business or a larger business. So the question really is Maine positioned to be able to move more quickly than the 2014 or this demonstration kind of stuff that's in the reform bill? Can we do this on our own pace, at a faster pace, in a way that's really going to change the cost curve significantly over the course of, say, the next 5 years? So I'd like to throw that out to maybe Elizabeth Assard and then Eric and Trish.
Thank you. I actually don't think we have any choice. Maine's commercial rates are the second highest in the country. I have a member who I was meeting with last week, a large employer in the state. He says he pays $165,000 a day for health care. That includes weekends. They have 12,000 employees. They quantify that as their opportunity cost. That's what they're not putting into their business. We don't have any choice but to do something about costs in Maine. The good news is, as I've said before, we have the collaborative forums. I don't think we want the employers to redesign the healthcare system by themselves. We need the providers at the table. What is the right care? What should we be paying for? How can we work together? But because Maine has a 15 to 20 year history of doing that collaboratively, I actually think we're extremely well positioned to accelerate this, to take advantage of every opportunity in the bill and move it along more quickly, and it's simply not optional.
I agree with Elizabeth. There's no waiting. I think we're foolish to wait. Maine will be on the economic shoals if it waits. We, as an employer and insurer of more than 10,000 people, are not waiting for this. We're aggressively into trying to flatten the cost curve for our company. And I think it's frankly possible. Multi-stakeholder groups and the initiatives of the coalition, the movement to accountable care organizations where big providers take on responsibility for controlling population costs. I think we're going to be doing projects on that in the next couple of years. I think you as companies, as employers, can do this. Try radical things. Give people a $1,000 discount off their insurance for getting to a healthy weight. If you take a 50-year-old and get them to a healthy weight from being 50 pounds overweight in the next 3 years, they may be able to get off their diabetes medicine, half their blood pressure medicines, get off their medicines for arthritis, reduce their risk of heart attack and stroke, et cetera. So try radical things in your own organizations. Shop for costs on high-end stuff. We know the cost of a colonoscopy in Maine ranges from $2,000 to $4,000. Shop for things that are costing your company a lot of money. I say that as a CEO of an organization that potentially suffers, but guess what? We're going to be doing radical things with our employee costs too, and we ultimately will adapt if you make these kinds of changes. So if you wait, I think you're screwed, frankly. That's a medical term.
Technical.
It's always good to follow Eric. I, of course, agree as well and would point to the website Health Cost. We do have some data in Maine that shows health activity by payer, by hospital, by provider, and it's a comparative that is available. I think the other kinds of things you can do as payers is, as some payers have found, by eliminating co-payments for the drugs that treat chronic illness, people are finding that chronically ill people are doing better and saving costs from inappropriate hospitalizations, those kinds of things we can do. Maine, I think, is uniquely, second to Massachusetts, prepared for health reform. We already have most of the insurance reforms in place in this state. and can adapt and adopt to them. We have a Medicaid program that already does pretty much what the federal reform asks us to do. The other states are going to catch up. And in DERIGO, we have the activity and the experience of what an exchange might be that could be moved. We could move beyond that and transition, because obviously there is not a need for a DERIGO choice product, I would argue, once the reforms kick in, nor is there a need for that assessment. And those dollars that are now part of the assessment, at least part of them could go to support health information technology and the kinds of things that Maine wants to invest in. And finally, DERIGO does remain, controversial as it is, a very important bridge to affordable coverage. Thanks to the legislature, the controversy of the financing has changed, and we will be able to open the program again in August to subsidized enrollment. So coupled with a federal grant that's now providing vouchers to part-time workers who have access to their employer coverage, we'll also open the program in August to subsidies, so it will be a bridge as we get ready for reform to have more uninsured people covered.
Okay, so getting to the questions that you all have submitted, they fall into different categories in my, you know, little laser-like mind that has categorized all of these. No, I'm just kidding. I want to start with maybe some questions around consumers. This is something that Dr. Steele raised and also Elizabeth in her presentation. And the question that this questionnaire is asking has to do with your example, Dr. Steele, of the patient and the CT scan. And the question was, so why didn't you actually, or your patient, look for the cheaper CAT scan?
That's a great question. I think there are a few reasons. One, no incentive doesn't come out of his costs. Most of it's covered by his insurance. Second, has no ready access to information about the cost, so can't do what I do if I want to fly to see my daughter in San Francisco, go onto Orbitz and compare prices, has no clue about quality. So I could have a CAT scanner in my garage and charge $200 for the procedure. And, you know, other than being a little suspicious, he would have no real way of knowing whether that's a good CAT scan and I have a good radiologist behind it, reading it. So other than having no incentive and no data, there are no barriers to him doing what you're talking about.
And following that, maybe a question for Elizabeth and maybe for Trish to chime in. This question of skin in the game, I mean, we've had a benefit design, a history of benefit design, redesign in this country to encourage greater consumer employee active engagement in their health care, and we use co-payments and deductibles and so forth and premium payments as a strategy for doing this, and we use other mechanisms as well. So question, what is the balance? How do we balance patient incentives and this need to be careful about assuring that appropriate care is accessible for patients and that we're not disadvantaging ourselves by not paying for things that actually save money? Does the reform bill help us in this respect? Do the things that we're doing in Maine drive us in the direction that we need to be going in terms of balancing these incentives?
Next question. Yeah.
I'll try. First of all, one of the things that I'm most optimistic about in the health bill is the funding and the requirement for additional measures of quality, outcomes, and cost. Now, that sounds boring, but if you don't have information, how can you be expected to make an informed choice about your health care? So let's start with that. Let's make sure we have transparent and meaningful information about the different quality and costs of different services. So hopefully that will come out of the bill eventually. There are also benefit design changes that we're starting to see in Maine. Maine is very progressive among many of its purchasers that we could spread. We should incent shared decision-making, like Eric was talking about. Have a copay differential if you do seek the information and participate with your provider in making an informed decision about a treatment. And all the research shows that once a patient has all the adequate information, they tend to be far more risk averse than their provider. They choose the least invasive therapy. So we're not saying we limit access to whatever choice they make, but let's make sure they have the information to make the right choice. Again, paying for primary and preventive care with no cost barriers. No cost barriers for a colonoscopy, for your regular primary care visit. Let's make sure we're not disincenting our patients from doing that the right thing. But, you know, if they want that third or fourth MRI, maybe they need to pay for it. They can get it. They can get it wherever they want, but it might not be covered. So we just need to think in those different categories. What is the care we know works? How do we make sure it's easily accessible? And then let's think about the care that may add lesser value and have a little bit more cost sharing.
And I think what the federal law clearly does, it's most important, is take front and center preventive care. So there is no cost sharing for preventive care so that people are incentivized to seek it. We do have in this state the Maine Quality Forum, which has data available. In the federal law, there's an investment in comparative effectiveness research, which means what works and what doesn't. But again, that death panel issue, the worry about rationing, raises its head too quickly and doesn't allow the research to come full bore, because in the language it says, as long as the comparative effectiveness research that's designed is not used to ration care, change benefit design, I mean, it's an academic exercise that can't be used for the purposes that Elizabeth just articulated. So I think we're a long way away, and I would argue that these kinds of discussions, no matter how much data we have, I'm almost concerned about data, too much data. Too much data is not information. What really matters, look at the mammography guidelines. Experts came out and said, don't need them all the time. And that one woman who had it at 30 said, saved my life. She was right. Experts were right too. So what's really needed are the Eric Steeles of the world and their patients to be able to have conversations around data that's available and make the decisions. And I would argue more important than the data even is the ability for people to understand it, to share it, and to have trusted advisors in the medical profession help them through it.
I think we all got to get comfortable with rationing. Despite what these folks said, we can call it whatever we want to, skin in the game or anything else, but if you think you can control these costs with unrestricted choice, you can forget it. If you don't think that we should be taking into account expert panels around whether or not everybody needs mammograms and can control costs, forget it. You think every motorcyclist can ride around without a helmet and it's their freedom of choice when we know that the lifetime cost of a severely head-injured patient exceeds $4 million? Forget that, too. You want to ride around with your cell phone, which is the equivalent on your driving risk of driving drunk, and you want to control your healthcare costs? Forget that, too. So we all have to get used to the idea of reconciling unrestricted choice with unrestricted cost increases. You can pick one or the other, not both. And we all are going to have to get comfortable with that really difficult discussion, or we won't be controlling these costs. We have to be smart about it. We have to support people in difficult decisions. But we got to get used to the idea of restriction on choice. My choice to spend money on unnecessary CAT scans, your choice to spend money on unnecessary tests, or driving around drunk talking to your sister, or whatever it is. We got to get used to it.
But we also have to recognize that it's a shared responsibility, and you can't just lay it all on personal responsibility. We also have to get used to every hospital have to have everything. Supply Yep. drives demand in the system. More and more stuff means more and more use, and more does not mean better health care. That's the one thing the research is clear about.
So I didn't mean that restriction to apply to me.
I knew it.
So let me just interject here and say that a number of you mentioned the financing reform as being the key to unlock this cost problem that we have, and that we really need to move to a different financing model that moves us away from paying for doctors to do things to paying doctors to do the things that really matter in terms of providing appropriate care and improving health. These so-called accountable care organizations, which are in the health reform bill and which are being discussed in Maine as we speak, are the vehicle for financing reform. The idea of financing reform in general terms is to, rather than pay a fee for service, that we're actually going to bundle payments and we're going to actually pay for outcomes and performance on some sort of, I'll use the word, global basis. We don't know exactly how that's going to work. But my question following on from this conversation is, why is it that consumers are not going to rise up and rebel at this notion that there is going to be a finite amount that an employer or a set of employers are going to pay for health care, and that physicians and patients entrusted with those resources are going to make the right decision? This is a political problem as much as it is a technical conceptual problem. So I just wonder, you know, what can we do to head off that problem?
Next question.
Consumers have to be at the table. They're not as savvy as all of us who deal in this insurance world all the time. It's about them. And we've got to all of us think like consumers first and think about what makes this system better for us. Let's be clear. Anybody who's, you know, sat at a hospital bedside with a chronically ill person and looked into the abyss of bad choices knows what a crazy system this is. Anybody who's looked at a healthcare bill and found out only after you're sick what your coverage doesn't cover knows how bad this system is. We have to change the payment system for the patient, not for the convenience of the rest of us. And unless and until we can figure out how to do that, patients should rise up.
All the studies that have come out in the last few years show that 30 to 50 to even 60% of healthcare services do nothing to improve the health of a patient. Nothing. So we have employers who call that waste in the system. Some of them call it toxic waste in the healthcare system. But how do you know what those services are as a patient? You don't. So there has to be a way to help convey to consumers, patients, whatever you want to call them, more is not always better. There is no correlation between quality and cost. And over-treatment carries its own risks. We're starting to see studies that show that MRIs actually increase your risk of other problems. We need to be able to make it clear that you don't necessarily need every service you think you do, and you can still have improved health. Now, is that easy? Absolutely not. But it's part of the challenge of bringing consumers and patients into the discussion.
You know, one of the best examples, we all know that hospitals are terribly unsafe places. Sad but true. It's a place of infection. It's a dangerous place. And you don't want to be there unless you need to be there. We also know that some Scandinavian countries don't have the problem with infections. Why, says the research, it's a simplistic summary of it, they don't use antibiotics like we do. We have antibiotic-resistant infections because we use antibiotics for everything. How many of us have had that cold this spring and gone to the doctors and said, maybe I need antibiotics? Maybe you don't. I mean, the fact is we overuse antibiotics, and we knew that earaches in kids don't necessarily need antibiotics. Now, telling that to a mom at 3 o'clock in the morning is not an easy thing to do. But we know that's true. You know when behavior started to change? When it was in good housekeeping. When it was in trusted sources of information that moms read. Mm-hmm. And we have to realize that. We have to find new ways to educate people about what we know the science says. It takes 15 years for best practices that we know about in research to become best practice in your doctor's office. That's wrong. That stuff has to be expedited for the patient for better care.
Trish, you raised the point that supply drives demand, and there is research that shows that that's certainly true. So the questioner is asking, why do we need so many hospitals in Maine? Do we have too many?
Could we have the next question?
Well, Eric, you put it out there in terms of the role of sure. The small rural hospital in Maine. So maybe we can start with you in responding.
Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that I think you can probably take care of the population of Maine with fewer hospitals. No, in the current model. if you take away those hospitals currently, you take away basically most of the care that their populations get. And it's not just the hospital care. So you really have to restructure how you run the health system and restructure reimbursement to ask the question. I can tell you this, I'll fight you tooth and nail on this question in the current model. Change the model, it will change the discussion.
Well, we have, over the past several years, moved many hospitals to critical access status, moved big hospitals to 25-bed hospitals like Blue Hill, where they have limited resources and they get paid higher by Medicaid and Medicare. At the same time, there's been an investment in health centers across the state. There's $11 billion of new spending in the federal reform bill for new health centers. Those are independent of state planning activities. They work directly federal government to health centers. What we need to think about, it seems to me, is the new iteration of critical access hospitals. There may not need to be a critical access hospital in some of these communities. There may need to be a really good ambulatory, urgent care kind of center next to a really good federally qualified health center. Or, heaven forbid, they might merge and be one entity. So I think we have to think differently about opportunity with all these new dollars for new health centers. Do we want to just create new health centers growing up next door to hurting small hospitals, or do we want to find new ways to integrate the two and support those communities, rural communities that need care?
Briefly.
Really brief. We've been talking about accountable care organizations, and I think that may change the game as well. If we are talking about moving towards primary care-based systems of care, it will change the role of hospitals and it will change the role of specialists. It'll be centered around a primary care-based system. So the question of do we need them or not is I'm not going to take that on, but there will be changes for all involved.
Well, thank you very much. That's all the time we have, unfortunately. So if you would, please give a round of applause to our speakers.
You've been listening to a panel discussion on healthcare reform and what it means for Mainers on Speaking in Maine. The speakers were Dr. Eric Steele, interim CEO of Blue Hill Memorial Hospital, Elizabeth Mitchell, CEO of Maine Health Management Coalition, and Trish Riley from the Maine Governor's Office of Health Policy and Finance. If you missed part of this program or wish to hear it again, you can access it online at mpbn.net. There, look under the On Demand tab for Audio On Demand, where you'll find this and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs, a service made possible by member support. Charles Beck is the executive producer of the program. For Speaking in Maine, I'm your producer and host, Gordon Fellis.